Today we kick off season 5 of This Is Actually Happening. To stay up to date on new episodes and other news, follow the Permatemp Corporation on Twitter at PERMATEMPCORP. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Permatemp Corporation, a presentation of the audio podcast, This Is Actually Happening.
Episode 62. What if you went on the strangest trip?
A lot of ambivalence in my life, like just feeling pretty ambivalent about having spent all this money to go to school, and this a lot of ambivalence about marriage, you know, just kind of a lot of malaise. I had just finished my master's degree in social work. I had just gotten a job, my first job out of school, working with adults with acute psychiatric illness. And I was only kind of a few months in when I realized that it was, you know, it was pretty overwhelming. And there were other things going on. I was engaged. I'd gotten engaged 8 or 9 months prior to that. I'd been talking to a couple of my good friends about it. And one of these friends was a twice divorced single dad with two different kids from two prior marriages. And he had for a year had been telling me how he had gone up and done ayahuasca at these ayahuasca ceremonies up in Northern California with some of his friends, and how it had changed his life, and he literally said it was like doing 5 years of therapy in 5 hours. Just all of the psychic trauma, you know, goes away. And he's an executive. I mean, this guy is, he works in green tech, and he said that, you know, the people that it was like through a friend, and it's at these private, it's like a very zen like retreat at this private home, and you pay this money and you have a shamanistic priest that comes in, and, you know, just kind of described it as this amazing kind of hippie transcendental experience. And a lot of people from the city would go and do this. And so he had been telling me about it, and I was kind of like, all right, because that's not really, it's not really my thing, you know. And the other thing he described about was that you puke your guts out for many, many hours. And so, but he, you know, either way, he persuaded me to try this out, to go with him for a retreat, it's called, for an ayahuasca retreat. And he would go with me and, you know, make sure that I was taken care of, and we would have this experience together. I'd done, you know, mushrooms and acid and stuff when I was in college, when I was a kid, but I hadn't done anything that intense from what I had read about it. About 3 days before we were both supposed to go up for the weekend, he called me to tell me he could not go anymore, that one of his baby mamas had changed the schedule and he was going to have his kid for the weekend. And I was like, okay, well, that takes care of that. I'm just not going to go then. And he was very upset. And he said, I really think that you should go, despite the fact that I'm not going to go. I already told, you know, my friend, she's going to take care of you. I've already talked to her about it. Like, you don't have to worry. She's going to be your guide. She was my guide. I trust her with my life. You know, you don't have to worry. So I was like, I don't know. But, you know, I wasn't sure. And then I talked to my fiance, and he was like, you should go. I think it's still a really good thing to do. I got an email back the week prior with directions on how to prepare myself for the ceremony and directions to this house, which was out in this rural part of Northern California, northeast of Napa. But the directions were very poor. They were like, you know, when you get to this bridge, go over and then you'll see like a blackberry bush, and bad directions. So I had my Garmin. I took off that afternoon. I was supposed to get there before 6 o'clock. I left the house by myself. I packed everything in my car. And the drive up through Napa was beautiful. It was a beautiful day, beautiful fall day. I didn't know what to expect. I'd heard it's not a pleasant experience doing ayahuasca. So I was scared. And so I have to go through a pretty intense mountain pass, pretty windy roads, switchback mountains. And then I get into this valley and, you know, my Garmin is giving me directions that I'm close. So it tells me to make a turn off of the main highway, which is this rural two-lane highway. And I'm supposed to go over a bridge, which in the hippie directions that this girl sent me had told me the same thing. You're going to go off of the main highway, you know, as you approach town, you're going to go over this small bridge over a creek. So now I'm looking at the hippie directions. They're not really making sense. I'm kind of driving around. I feel like I'm close. I had hit what landmarks that I thought I was supposed to have hit. And I was driving down and I heard barking dogs and I could see like trailers kind of off in the distance. And it just was like, okay, I'm not going to keep driving down this road. And in the email, it said, you know, please be aware not to disturb our neighbors. Like sounds really disturb them. And kind of like a beware, but like a veiled beware, just kind of like just stay to where you're supposed to go. It was starting to get darker. I mean, it wasn't quite dusk yet, but I realized, okay, I'm lost. So I pick up the phone and I call the girl that's supposed to be my guide. And I'm like, can you guys maybe come down the road and meet me at the main road? And she's like, oh, I decided to leave early. Like, I'm actually headed back to Oakland right now, so I'm not there. So I was pissed. I'm on the phone with her on my cell phone, and she's kind of guiding me based on where she thinks I'm at. So I pull up a little farther to where I can kind of make a U-turn. So I turn my car around, and I'm driving pretty slow, like maybe 5 miles an hour. And I hear pop, pop, pop. I'm on the phone with her and I kind of pause and she's like, are you okay? And I'm like, nah, I kind of think I heard something, but I keep driving. And maybe 20 or 30 seconds after I heard that noise, I see a man, no shirt, raggedy jeans, no shoes, just running full speed at my car. I see him through the passenger side window and he is maybe 20 feet from me at this point. And I see in his hand, now, I'm not a gun expert, but it looked like a small Uzi. You know, he had come probably from the house, but he was running, and he was kind of parallel to my car, but I could tell that he was trying to get in front of my car. So at this point, I scream into the phone. I scream, there's a man with a gun, and I throw my phone down, and I just slam on the gas, trying to get the hell out of there. So I go down this hill, and all I can see is the highway, and I'm not that far, and I'm like 10 feet from the bridge. At this point, I hear another loud noise, and this time it's a shot that has blown out my rear window. I feel impact near my head. I smell gunpowder, and I lose control of my car. Everything's kind of slowed down at this point, and I miss the bridge by like 3 or 4 feet. To the right, and I go off the side of the embankment and I start to plunge down the embankment. At that point, I'm thinking, oh my God, this is how people die. And then I realize, oh my God, I'm going to die. Luckily, there was a tree there, like at the bottom with branches, and there's like brush because it's November. It kind of noses down and crashes vertically, but basically, like, all of these branches kind of slow me down. And now I am trapped in my car. And I feel my head, and there's just blood gushing down all over me on my shoulders and face. And I have so much adrenaline in my system, I can't feel anything. My car is still running, it's still on, and I can't open the doors. Basically, there's branches and brush all around me that are just like pinning me in. And all I can think is this guy is gonna come down and blow my brains out. My car's vertical. I like crawl over into the passenger side and try to hide under as small as I can get down under the glove compartment kind of area. And I had a jacket in the back seat, and I just pulled the jacket from in the back seat and just kind of pulled it over me to try to hide myself. And I'm just waiting there, just waiting to basically die. I mean, I had no idea what had just really occurred and why. I couldn't feel anything. You just have so much adrenaline, and my heart was just pounding and racing. And I couldn't find my phone. I couldn't find my purse. I couldn't find anything. There was just so much, you know, everything was disheveled. And I was like, you know, 100% certain that the last thing I was going to see was him coming down there and just shooting me at point blank range. And so I just hid there and waited for what felt like an eternity, and said my goodbyes, and yeah. Everything kind of speeds up and slows down and speeds up and slows down. And the first thing I hear is someone yelling, "I'm calling 911. I kind of slowly peek up, and I see through the blown out window a younger guy and a girl, not the same guy. And they're yelling down at me because they had found, you know, they'd seen my car, and they were yelling down, you know, "Are you okay? Are you okay?" And I said, "No, I'm not. Someone shot at me. Call the police." And he said, I called 911, and I didn't realize how perilous and like scary even my car was, but he was amazing. He's a young guy. I mean, I want to say like maybe 22 or something. He like came down and like stood on the hood of my car, and I basically crawled up through the back seat and then through the windshield, and he just stood there and pulled me up through the car and then took me and threw me over him like 5 feet onto the embankment. And at this point, like in some weird magical, I don't know how this happened, but a paramedics van just like shows up like within a minute of that happening. At this point, it's dark, so they saw lights in the creek from my car and decided to come and see if, you know, what was going on. So I immediately tell them kind of what happens. And I was explaining to the guy, you know, I said, "Someone shot at me." And he immediately said, "Where, you know, from where?" And I pointed, I said, that house that up there. I mean, I could see, you know, the property line through the bushes. I said, "Right up there." And he said, "Was it a skinny guy?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "I think I know who that is." He goes, "That house has been known to shoot at cars. Like, they're bad." So the paramedics pulled me in to the paramedics van and were asking me a bunch of questions and trying to, you know, figure out what was going on. And they had realized that I had gotten really lucky, and I had just gotten shot in through the ear. When I kind of could get a little bit more of my bearings back and I wasn't in this just like total survival mode of thinking back, I thought, man, like getting sick later in life, like, and like sitting, you know, laying in bed and saying all your goodbyes to all of your friends and family, like that seems okay to me. This, like being in my car, not prepared to die, thinking it was going to happen any minute, that was not okay. Like, it felt horrible. This immense, incredible, more than anything, just sadness and regret and disbelief. I mean, I think there's a certain disbelief, like, this can't be how this is going to happen. Like, I just left my house 2.5 hours ago, and I was headed to a fucking retreat that was supposed to, like, be this amazing, you know, life-changing, beautiful commune with the spirits experience. And here I am, like, you know, in this incredibly perilous, violent scenario. There's ambivalence about people until you think you're never going to see them again. And then, but it was just my parents and my fiance. That was the only people that I thought about. That was it. 3-4 people. It was basically a SWAT team that showed up. I mean, they came like full, you know, gear, like deck to the nines, and they were asking me questions, and they did a big sweep of the property. So the paramedics asked if I wanted to go to the hospital, and I had terrible health insurance. I had like a Kaiser HMO. Because, you know, again, I'm working in community mental health. You're working in, and, you know, you just, so I was really nervous. I was like, are there any Kaisers up there? And they were like, and then I didn't know. And they were like, oh, no. And I was like, oh, God, they're going to, you know, if I don't go to a Kaiser hospital, they're going to, like, charge me. I had had an experience where I'd been charged, like, you know, $4,000 to go to the hospital for, like, a allergic reaction. She was like, you don't look like you have anything broken. Like, I had no broken bones. And she looked at my ear, and it had just taken, like, a little piece off. And the bullet that hit. And she was looking at my ear, and she's like, well, actually, normally you probably would need stitches, but it looks like the bullet cauterized the wound. She's like, it seared it, so it's not bleeding anymore. And I was like, what? And she's like, so you don't technically actually need to do anything except cover it right now. They take me to the fire station, and the sheriff showed up and told me there was an illegal marijuana grow on the property. Later, the sheriff was like, oh, didn't you know it was harvest season? Like, it's harvest season time up here in this county. And, like, you know, this is a really dangerous time of year to be up here because everybody's harvesting their marijuana and they're super paranoid. And they've been up for days doing meth because they've been, you know, like, trimming their crop. So I think they were trying to ascertain, like, who I was and if this was, like, a drug deal gone bad or... So I think once they realized, like, okay, this is not a drug pin and, you know, she was going to a meditation retreat and, you know, they found the, like, vegan macaroni salad, like, all over my car, they were like, okay. So my fiancé... you know, has called and has tracked me down there and says he was close. And then I get another call at the station after that, and it's this chick, and she's tracked me down. So the first thing she asks me, I'm pissed at this chick. Oh my God, I'm so glad you're okay. Like, oh my God, I'm so worried. And so, like, I know you're, like, a social worker, and so you're probably really good in crises, but I'm just, like, wondering what you, like, told the police about where you were going. What did you tell the police? And I was like, I told them that I was going to a meditation retreat. Good, 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 good. So, okay. I know this is really not a good time for you, but the folks back at the house are trying to figure out what to do, if they should start the ceremony or not. So I kind of need to, like, I'm trying to figure out, like, how, like, what are the chances that you think that the police might show up? Like, did you give them the address of the house? I was like, yeah, I gave them the address of the house. I told them where I was going. Do you think that they're going to, like, what's the likelihood that you think that they're going to show up tonight? I was like, honestly, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. I don't really fucking care. And she's like, oh, okay, well, I'm not trying to worry you. We're just, like, trying to figure stuff out. Oh my God, I'm just so glad you're okay. And, like, before she ends, she says, wait, she says this to me. She says, let me know tomorrow if you want me to come to your house to do some healing on you. She goes, I used to do crisis support like you, but now I practice magic. And she says, and I will come to you, and I will come and do healing on you. I just want to let you know I'm there for you. She heard me scream into the phone, the gunshots. She thinks she knows where I am, at least very close by. So she could have called the police and said, hey, there's this woman I'm really worried about. I was on the phone and I think she might be shot and bleeding to death. She didn't want to call the police because she didn't want any kind of heat because they make a lot of money on these ceremonies. And she doesn't want, God forbid, you shut down the ayahuasca ceremony and, like, you know, tech douche number two can't go and have his, like, Lizard King moment in the, like, Zen garden and pay them, like, $300. The police tried to have me do they asked me if I could try to do a photo ID. I couldn't do it. I mean, I just was too freaked out. I was, like, in a fetal position the whole time I was there, just simply from the amount of adrenaline in my system. I can't imagine people going to war and having that level of adrenaline for, like, 6 months, because it literally felt like someone was just, like, punching me in the stomach for, like, 5 days afterwards. You just are so overwhelmed. They towed my car out of the creek and brought it to the fire station where I was. And there were, like, 7 bullet holes in my car, and they had numbered them. Like, already they had started processing the car, and so there were like numbers where the holes were, and the one that hit my ear was like went dead center through my headrest. I was kind of still on a down angle, so I had my head to the side when he shot the last shot that went through the headrest. What freaks me out, honestly, and it's a beautiful kind of freak out, but still, for a long time, and I think that was some of the PTSD and the fear, is like, how did I survive this? Because there were so many points in that little timeline and that quick, you know, however many minutes this played out, where I should have died. And honestly, you know, I think back, like, why didn't he come down and shoot me? There were, especially the first couple months afterwards, I was like, every time I, you know, would go out of the house in the car and, you know, go to work in the morning, I was like looking outside my window just to see, like, are there any suspicious cars around, like anything. Because I was like, I'm the only person that can put this person in jail. And he was facing, like, if he got convicted, he could get up to 10 years. I tried to kind of make sense of everything. I mean, I was traumatized and I couldn't believe what had happened to me, and I couldn't, you know, it was so hard to talk about or tell anybody. I didn't tell my parents for like a week afterwards. I only took 3 days off of work, which now seems totally crazy. You know, I working in mental health, and I ask for like, and I need a break from it, and I can't get one. I was having panic attacks and I was having nightmares and all of those things that I'd never experienced before, and, you know, were like the textbook things that happen. I literally couldn't hold food down for 3 days. I guess it's like a sense of, like, I'd be walking into the kitchen and then all of a sudden I'd feel like I wasn't there. Like, you know, like you have this, I can't even describe it. It's almost like a deja vu moment, kind of, where you're like, am I here or am I there? You get so disoriented in that instant, and then you immediately, you know, start to panic. And it was just those kinds of little shifts throughout the day, or, you know, of course, any loud noises. If I was getting freaked out, I'd actually, one of the things I would do is I'd go in the bathroom and I'd press my hands against the wall like this, and I'd just try to, you know, feel the wall and feel my feet and just feel like, okay, I'm here in this room and I'm safe. These are the walls and these are the floors, and I'm not out of my body. Because that was part of it, was like these instances of feeling where you don't know kind of where you are. Dealing with rural, like a rural sheriff's department, is like a whole other level. I did get really lucky. The sheriff that I had was very, very kind, and you know, he was pursuing all these leads, and I was calling each week to kind of find out what was going on with my case. We do have some leads, he's like, but I really feel like the key piece is still, you know, you making an identification. Like, how would you feel about trying to do another photo lineup? And I was like, yes. And I saw his face again, and I was like, this is the guy. That's him. Like, I'm just getting that sick feeling of adrenaline in my stomach again, and I'm just like, that's him. You know, a couple weeks later, he told me that they had made, you know, that was the suspect that they had thought, and they were gonna, and they had made an arrest for 3 counts for 3 felony charges. One was illegal cultivation of marijuana, and the other two were shooting on an occupied vehicle and assault with a deadly weapon. Not attempted murder, which is what it was, but the DA's reasoning, and again, these are all these things that you don't know, but the DA was like, well, you know, the reason we're not doing that is because attempted murder is much harder to prove. You have to prove intent, and there's like way less of a conviction rate on it. And this way, you know, these are very clear-cut charges and much easier to prove and much easier to get a conviction on, and added up, you know, 3 felony counts, 2 violent felonies, like he'll be looking at the same amount of time, roughly. You know, he asked if I could come up for the preliminary hearing to give testimony a few months later, and I said I would. And that was the first time I had to see him in court, which was horrible. You know, the DA that they gave me was this Iraq war vet. He was tough as balls, dude. He was terrifying. He was amazing. And he met with the defense attorney, and the defense attorney said that they would plead out, he would plead guilty to misdemeanor brandishing a weapon charge. And the DA was like, fuck you, no. One of the worst parts about the whole process when you're the victim is that you do not get to, they try to keep you in the dark as much as possible because it makes you a better witness. The other thing is you can't be in the courtroom anytime except when you're testifying. So the whole time that this whole trial, it was a 3-day trial, is going on, you only get to be in the courtroom for your testimony. That's it. The DA that was like the bulldog, like that DA that I really liked, he got pulled onto like a triple Hell's Angel homicide case up in the same county, like last minute. And so they put on this newer, younger DA. They gave him this case like a month before trial, so he had to catch up on everything. And then the jurors are all in the same county and like not the most sophisticated folks, and I'm the only witness to the crime. The cross-examination was just, it was like something from a movie. His defense attorney was this greasy, like he had a mullet, like curly black hair mullet. He's like the marijuana attorney up there, and he makes a lot of money off of these guys doing his best to discredit you and get you upset. And you just have to sit there and take it in front of the guy that tried to kill you. And he's sitting 20 feet away, staring you down the whole time. You know, and then there are things that you should remember that you can't remember. Some things are super crystal clear and some things are blurry. And of course, you know, that to the jury is like, well, how can she remember one thing? But that's how the brain is, you know? So it just was this exercise in just like absurd frustration and anger and humiliation. 6 people wanted to convict and 6 people were like, and that's it. He did not get acquitted, nor did he get convicted. It was a hung jury. So he got off.